It's become a very clear embodied marker for me if I am starting to feel responsible for an individual's learning process.
How do you notice that? Because it sounds to me like you know your alarm bells, so to say. Are you willing to share that?
Yeah, for me, it shows up as constriction and like tension. Like I can feel it if I leave a class, or even if just thinking about like prepping for a class. If I'm like my body tensed up, my shoulders go up, my stomach clenches, my throat clenches, the back of my tongue will get really tight. I'll start to like pull my eyebrows together. And it's a bracing posture. Like it is a posture of trying to protect myself, trying to protect,
Control also. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely control and protect. And it is exhausting. It takes a lot of energy. And it doesn't feel good. Like it's such a contrast to when it's a collective responsibility. Like I'm the facilitator, or if like Manu's the course assistant, Manu and I are the facilitators. But each person in the learning environment is responsible for showing up and taking responsibility for their own learning experience and for contributing to our collective learning. So if I'm taking on too much responsibility, then I'm not allowing them to show up. Yeah, it is like back.
Yeah, like Heather Platt, The Art of Holding Space, she calls it the opposite of holding space is actually hijacking space. And like you are taking control away from the other of their authentic process for some reason, probably.
Right. Yeah.
Not in the present moment, like you said before. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one to let educators also sink in of where do you and how your body is speaking to you often earlier than your mind is, right? To catch yourself, to really go back to those moments like, oh, where can I release or maybe activate a little bit? It, you know, probably show up as both ways, right?
Absolutely. Yep. So continuing to notice those sensations in my body is super, super helpful.
Yeah.
And part of why I do this practice at the beginning of the class is for me as much as it's for the students.
Yeah,
So
right? Yeah.
Allow myself to arrive and be present also. I feel supported. I feel nourished and connected and a part of something bigger than me. So that also helps me to remember that I'm not responsible for everything that happens in this classroom. Like I can't be responsible for what so-and-so thinks, or if so-and-so is upset by this particular teaching. I can be responsible for how I show up and the integrity and the intention that I bring, but intention doesn't always equate effect. And that can be really frustrating as an educator to find peace in.
Yeah. I see you nodding, Emanuela. Do you have maybe a different experience or situation or...
It's just such a real gift. I mean, I'm a person that lives in this world. I can really connect with this world. So for me, it's just a gift to be able to see how in small ways or in really big ways, someone's experience changes in a classroom with how they're engaging with themselves and also with the material. Like, you know, like I've had the great opportunity to be a course assistant with Khaki for a couple courses now, and every class has its own little like microsystem, and every class has its different wonders and magics and challenges is of course, but the common theme is that everyone has some sort of experience, which is really just wonderful to be able to honestly. And I think I put more responsibility on myself than I need to, and I know that. However, I think student that's also gone through the course, both act like academically and also understands I've had experience with the invitations that Khaki gives. I think I put a lot of responsibility to show up as authentic as I can be, because I think in there's a lot of value in other people's experiences, whether they contrast to yours or they're really intertwined with yours. And I value the fact that in doing these exercises and holding myself accountable to my own practice, I can show up in that way that students may resonate with someone closer to their age or my actual peers are in the same, cohort, not too far behind, are really seeing how, if they choose and if they want this for themselves, they can reach their own point in this journey, like I have continued to reach points in my journey. So it's just really wonderful. So I nod because everything is just bringing me back to those days. And I just resonate with so much of what's been said.
And Manuela, as well as one of my other former course assistants, whose name is Alyssa, have both done a really beautiful job of modeling. Okay, I think I'd like to request that we take a collective breath. And just naming that and normalizing that it is an option that we can do that and that we can feel a difference as a class if someone names that and puts that request out there and we're able to meet that need, how that shifts that we are a responsive community who can recognize our own needs and meet them and create a little bit of space. Just let's take a collective breath before we move on to the next person's presentation.
It's like the thermostat, right? You're being the thermostat, and also at the same time, and live an example of, oof, I'm sensing something here, or let's just and throw the invitation, see what happens, to pause or take a breath, shift the thing, because that's it, right? Shifting always create just a tiny difference can already influence the whole setting of the present moment experience, equal the learning experience.
Yeah, and doing it in a way of let's do one breath together feels very different than okay, we're gonna take a 2-minute bio break, like go off and do your thing individually and come back. Like both have their place at different times, but the invitation to do something as a shared experience is also so reaffirming of the container and of the community.
Shall we do it now? Just take one breath together.
Let's
Just
do it.
let's do it. Let's take a deep breath in. Fill your sit bones, and then, if you'd like, with an open mouth, collective sigh. There's a topic here that I'm holding for you, Emanuela, because I was already thinking about them because you said you're a lot of course assistant in Keki's courses, but you also work, and you mentioned this before, like the way everybody experiences is also different in different ages. And you teach 3.5-year-olds until 5th grade, where you do a lot of somatic work. So how is it different to work with embodiment there? That's my first question. So let's start there, and then you probably bring in something more for us to dive in
Okay.
your work.
I'm currently, and I've been with the past year as well, volunteering with a nonprofit organization that helps children, teens, and adults grieve and process expressive arts therapy. And my specific experience has been with the 3.5-year-olds, the little littles, as we call them, to older, like 4th through 5th grade. And genuinely, that experience in connecting grief and embodiment, and also just supporting grief through embodied teaching, is is vastly different. At the same time, it's not, because I think with the littles, they're the way that they're still living through the world is through their bodies, like the way that they're still experiencing all of it, like their relational abilities is through themselves physically. And it's really magical to kind of invite little moments of pause when they're so bouncing off the walls, as I say, or they're feeling really low energy or experiencing anything other in between. But this work in this specific setting, I think, comes back to a lot of play and informed play, and also inviting them to kind of into that autonomy that we keep speaking about and we've spoken about this whole time of like, I am feeling a big emotion right now, or if they're really dysregulated, you know, me myself, it comes more with modeling, you know, like I model for them what might be accessible to them in that moment. So, for example, just yesterday I was in group. And I was with the littles, and one of the kids just came in with so much energy. And I got down to the floor, like as low as I could get, to really be eye to eye with this child. And I was just like, oh my goodness, I see that we're so excited. You had a good day. What's going on? And then match their level of energy for a moment, and then slowly started regulating myself, being like, oh, we got a fun day ahead of us too, but let's take a big breath before we even step into the room. And in the threshold of the door, we took a big breath and we let it out. And then I invited this kid to wiggle. We're like, okay, here we go. We're gonna get ready. And then we walked into the room, and while they were still energetic, the shift was already happening for them to be able to come together to know. Because they know what happens in that room. Like they understand that we have a process and a way of doing things and a ritualistic aspect to it. So it's kind of just inviting them to kind of begin that shift for themselves. At least for the littles, that's what I found. And for the older kids, honestly, we do a lot of invitational regulations now. That's been something that this program has. Really been intentional in providing the kids, because there's just a
Could you
lot
tell me what that is? Could you explain, like,
of. Yeah, totally. So it varies from like, there's deck of cards that have like little quick breathing exercises that focus on three main categories, like calmness, focus, or energy. There's also these two books that are called Alpha Breaths, which are kind of really informational books on how to teach younger kids to mindfully breathe while still cultivating their imagination and play. And for the older kids, there's a bunch of cards that kind of play on vitality, connection, and calmness as well. And it kind of invites them to begin to form connections with these tools and different types of breathing styles that might feel more accessible to them. Like one of the vitality ones is called, I can't remember the name, but it's that technique that you use when you're feeling like you want to warm up or cool down. Like the different ways of holding your mouth to breathe to invite like a rush of coolness or heat yourself up. And it's just, it varies. Like there's some that are very much like yoga natured based, like they invite them to hold a posture and breathe, or like the one I did yesterday was they were feeling a little bit low energy towards the end because it's later in the evening, and it's called lion breath, and it invites them to imagine they're a sleepy lion that's waking up with their claws in the air. And as they're wiggling and stretching, they're taking big breaths in, and as they let it out, they go like ah, and like really vocally express themselves. Yeah, so it sort of varies from very playful in nature, but really necessary to invite that moment of stillness, of pause, of re-engaging, re-regulating together as a whole group. Yeah.
Beautiful. And What do you see changing when you work through this with the children, like over a longer period of time? Because in the moment, of course, it can be fun and relaxing. What is the impact? Do you notice anything with the littles, as you sweetly call them? Every time my heart is jumping when you say that. Also the way you say it, I guess, with the, such love and playful, I feel. And then in the older ones too.
So with the littles, they start asking for a moment. They start inviting those moments in group, or they themselves take the autonomy to either by themselves, because the cards are in the room.
Yeah.
Depending on reading levels, of course, we read it to them, or they themselves can read them for themselves. But they themselves will sometimes say, "Can I go step outside for a moment? Can you come step out with me and we'll do a breathing exercise?" Or they themselves vocally express, "I'm feeling like I need a moment for myself," and start playing with a different toy. They start craving that moment to like recontain, because they know that what they're sharing about people in their life that have died, requires active presence. Like the vulnerability that comes with sharing your grief, with sharing your experience with grief, even though at that age it's so concrete and kind of, is not as profound as vocally and developmental age comes into effect later. But they want to be heard. They want to feel that their peers in group are fully and authentically being with them, just like they are being with them. So it's really magical when they start, like we can't do a group without having some sort of regulation. They call us out on it. They're like, "We didn't do our breathing ball." And we're like, "You're totally right. Thank you for reminding me. Do you want to facilitate that? Like, do you want to do that?" And they will do it. And it's just magical. And with the older kids, I found that it allows them the, it's more useful to them to kind of use it for a moment of pausing after sharing when the environment gets really tense and dense, because what they're sharing with their capacity for sharing more profound things with words, the shift in the rooms are constant, because one kid's sharing one level, but they're all, one of my mentors says, going down the elevator of yourself. So one, like the elevator is going down and they're all going down together and
The
shifting from.
collective nervous system, right? That's created in that sharing and connected space, the container you build.
Totally. So shifting from when we're discussing what came up for us in the activity to then having free time, they kind of need something to break up that space or break up that dense
To
and
transition.
transition. It really is more for the transitional pieces. But again, they like doing the ones that are meant for the littles, because it invites a different part of their brain to play, and they can themselves be reminded what it is to play. So it's just really profound and magical to witness.
Becky, do you want to say anything to just bring your voice in the room before I want to bring her example, the great creatures in?
I am just so proud of Emanuela and how she is embodying and living these practices and the communities that she is sharing this invitation to co-regulate and find tools that they can use outside of the house too. Yeah, I think the ripple effect, we've used that metaphor a few times, is something that we'll never really know how impactful all of these micro ways of supporting embodiment and connection are going to live out into the world. So thank you, Emmanuel, for what you do.
Thank you.
So to ripple those grief creatures further to maybe come into more classrooms or situations where grief, support is needed. Can
Totally.
you share with us what those grief creatures are and how you work with them and how the children respond?
The Children's Room, which is the name of the organization, is and has a phenomenal job in creating activities that kind of tether to inviting kids to engage with them in different ways. And this activity really plays on the multimodal transfer of emotions and experiences. And by what I mean by that is that a kid can enter into this really cognitively and want to just do it on a mind level, but as the activity progresses, it shifts and changes. So grief creatures, and we're very intentional with the language at TCR, the children's room, and we don't call them grief monsters because that can just create a negative or a heavier association with grief itself, where we're trying to normalize grief and make sure grief is integrated into their lives, as grief is something that never goes away. So grief creatures are an activity where we have these boxes that have four sides, and they also have a lid. And the invitation is for the children to be curious about what their grief as a creature would look like, if it has spikes, if it has fur, if it has multiple faces, which is why we have the four faces, so that because it can be different in different moments. So if you want to have a smiley face, a frown face, a open mouth, as if yelling, anger, jealousy, like kind of for them to be curious in what type of emotions does their grief creature embody. And what's really neat about this activity is that once they create it, they're given background paper, they're giving scissors, they're given stickers, they're giving pipe cleaners to make horns, they're giving like different facial expressions, they're given all and above to kind of create this three-dimensional aspect of what is living internally in them at the moment in time. And then my favorite part, which kind of brings in the embodiment, is once they're created, we invite them to kind of have a very playful nature into thinking, what does your creature move like? Or how does your creature move? Or what does your creature say? Does it sing? Does it growl? Does it scream? Does it whisper? Does it feel strong and can stand steady? Or is it like a blob and needs to like jiggle? And you can kind of just see how the room gets taken over by these children embodying their grief creature. And it's really, really magical because it kind of becomes like they're not themselves in a way. They're a really essential part of themselves, which is their grief for what they're experiencing. And the way they're relationing themselves with each other's like grief creatures is wonderful. It becomes like this just a different world in that class, in that room, in that specific moment, where there's all sorts of things happening and everything is accepted. Of course, maintaining like safe bodies and making sure we're kind to each other and respectful, there are limits around that. But other than that, it's really wonderful to witness.
You have an example. Can you just pull it up for just to be
I have a
witnessing there?
pictures. And then, as I mentioned, that it has a lid. The purpose of the lid is actually, we also want to tie back that in feeling your grief, it's also your ability to also remember, and hold memories and moments and spaces for yourself in that relationship. So the children are invited to write words or memories or stories that then their grief creature can protect and keep safe. So it's really, really special. So I have some examples I can show you. Let me just open them all. And then I have a silly example of me at the end, which I'm happy to share as well.
Love it. And I haven't even seen it.
Yeah, I know. I'm giving you a little tease. Okay. So, this is an example of what the grief creatures end up looking like. Are you able to see this?
Yes.
Okay. So as you can see, all the little faces, all the different emotions, all the different colors they could use, the pipe, containers. They even use, like, up here on the one on the left, that's a paper cup that they use for drinking water that they've made into some sort of hat or ear. I'm not quite sure. I don't remember quite well.
I saw a boat.
Yeah. Who knows what their imagination was at the
Yeah.
moment. But this is what kind of they look like. And some kids even do the bottom. Some kids put so many different faces. This is one example I can show you. Then there's also this one. Let me see. This is just another angle of that same moment. Can you see it?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. And then for the words, let me pull up the words. This is from a group of pre-KKer group, so the littles, as I call them. This is the words that were written by a kid themselves. Of course, with the helping of spelling in some ways, but they chose to do it how they wanted to. So here we have loved, sick, amazing, scared, cold, hurt, and lonely. And these are all the words that kind of went into their box, and many more. Yeah. And then the silly example is, because I don't make example myself, because I have to facilitate. Sometimes I do have the space if the kids are older. I do have the space, but in this specific group, they love playing with me and I love playing with them. And they came up to me and just said, we're gonna make you our group grief creature and put faces on me. And I quickly took a picture because it was too cute. And they started to ask me, what does your grief sound like? Or how would you move? Or is your grief creature silly? Because you're silly. And I was like, it can be. And it can also be really angry. And it can also be really silent. And it also, half the time, just really wants a hug, if you ask me. So it was just a moment where I got to embody really myself and my grief in not a box shape or form, but just kind of be with them in that moment in time. And I remember I ended up crawling on the floor and rolling over and laughing and just trying to also model that it can be so many things and not limited to one or another. And the laughter that just comes from that and the playfulness that comes from that is just something that I think is really important to keep reminding everybody who's experiencing grief that you can hold both, and it doesn't have to be one and another.
The both and. Yeah. This sounds so empowering. Such a true way of finding a voice for the undercurrent. Beautiful work. And I have a question. You talked about safe bodies, you said,
Yeah.
that sounded like something of a boundary or rules. Can you quickly help unpacking that?
So at the children's room, there are group guidelines which every kid and adult and facilitator needs to follow. And some of them are I'll be kind to myself and others. I pass, which is where we respect that if they don't want to share something in that moment, that is perfectly acceptable and encouraged and welcomed. Also, what's said here stays here, just to protect their own experience and what they're sharing, and to really gel the group and what we're here together experiencing this, and it shouldn't be taken out of this room, unless, of course, if safety reasons or safety concerns are involved, that's different. But and then we have one that's going to be added really soon, but we've started implementing it, which is safe bodies, because there's such need for because the spaces are not that big, to be honest. The rooms aren't that big, and there's like 10 kids in the room plus the adults, so it's just a lot of little bodies plus big bodies in a room.
And a lot of emotions.
Yes. So safe bodies is the guideline to make sure that kids are really being kind to themselves while also asking for consent before in touching other folks or friends, or even what it would feel like if someone really wants to hug you after you share something and you're like, at this moment, I don't want to. And just when they play, when they have free play, it kind of just gets a little wilder because they want to play fight and tackle each other and all of this. So it's just like this constant reminder of like you are allowed to kind of change your mind and see how you're feeling it every day and really listening to that and voicing that for other kids to know and for the adults to know and et cetera.
Wow, what an ownership, or what a lesson to learn about. This is my body, and it's for me to hold, and it's for me to decide in such true and deep. Like Zoom is also interfering. Containers you work with together, and at such a young age, that is so beautiful. What a gift if we would receive those students in class, Keki, later on, who are actually body literate, I would say. Like, wow. Thank you for sharing that and with our listeners and viewers in the world.
Pleasure, my absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Keki, is there any from you in this?
I love that there is, I love the work that Emanuela is doing and the way that you're talking about embodied literacy. So many of these same tools and skills and practices that Emmanuel is doing with the littles is what I'm doing in the university classroom. So it just goes to show how profound these seemingly quote unquote simple practices can be, regardless of age, regardless of demographic, in inviting us into connecting with our bodies, connecting with each other in ways that are healthy and safe and enlivening.
So important. Actually, that sounds already like a beautiful wrap up of everything, because I'm also looking with an eye towards the time. And so true and necessary to have more of those spaces. Yeah. Any last words from you, Emanuela, that you like to bring in the space before we close off?
I just appreciate that there's people like you that want to keep this conversation expanding and growing, and the whole community that wants to start. I don't know if start's the right word, but that have been teaching from an embodied perspective or want to begin to start teaching from an embodied perspective, that it just really requires the genuine curiosity to feel what that's like for yourself and for what it's like to share that with others in your life. And I'm a big believer in you may not know how to do something just right yet, but just having the conversation and just keeping that curiosity alive is just so important. And sooner or later, you might begin, or you might start, or you might reawaken something. And it's just to keep going. I think that's, I'm still in this journey. I'm still going through this journey. I still have so much to learn in this journey. And I'm just always playing with how to keep that curiosity alive in a way that's responsible for myself and comfortable and inviting and just playful in nature for others. So thank you for this opportunity,
I
genuinely.
even feel like you're breathing that. Like, if you talk about core values, it's so inside you that whenever you speak, the way we interact, I feel that already. So it's there, and it's a gift to
Thank you.
experience that. Yeah, it really is. Becky, any last words from you, and to close off?
I am so grateful that this space exists, that you are cultivating this community of educators who are passionate about embodiment and understand the very practical value of bringing even, 1% of somatics into the classroom, how transformational that can be. And we were talking before the call. I know that fundamentally, education is informational. That is one piece. But to me, that's an incomplete picture. And so incorporating embodiment practices, somatics, is so effective in deepening our relationship with ourselves, understanding ourselves in a deeper way, with each other and with the material, that learning gets to be relational. And through that combination, informational, relational, and all of the layers of embodiment, education, it's setting the stage for education to be transformational. And it's such a privilege to get to interact with folks who want to learn, from the little littles all the way up to my doctoral students. I try so hard to center and honor those unknown ripple effects that can come from even micro interactions. Because it is world changing. It's changing the world for one student. I was sharing about my experience with Mrs. Molt that changed my world. And through creating a community of educators doing this work, we are changing the world. We are making the world a more playful and joyous and curious and embodied and relational place that I want to live in.
And actually, while you're speaking, I think it also, because if you look at it only informational, you're moving away from the body being part of this learning, even though it is, without addressing it in its full potential. I mean, disembodied, but it's so beautiful what you're saying, that it becomes relational, and then there's the body involved already, in which you can lean and tap into, and makes the learning so much deeper, richer, and extending further, like you both shared through already experiences when you were so little. So you've done amazing in explaining that for me, and I hope our listeners too, that it's such a beautiful foundation to lean on in learning in every possible way and age. If people want to find you, before I close down, because I was almost like, all right, where can they find you?
Yeah, so you can find me. I have a professional Instagram, Somatic Reclamation. That's also my website, somaticreclamation.com. And you can find me on LinkedIn.
I'll put them in the show notes, Emanuela.
Right now, at this moment, I have my LinkedIn. I also just have my email that I'm happy to, if people reach out there too.
Perfect. I can reconnect with that and put them in the show notes, so the all the questions regarding grief creatures, maybe, and all that beautiful work you do, and the higher education context of somatic work that you facilitate and well create and facilitate together with Emanuela. They can reach out to you, Kaki. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Wonderful beings to share my time with you and learning from you.
Thank you.
That's ripple.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for being with us and being part of the Embodied Educator community. I hope you found some nourishment in this conversation. If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the Embodied Educator channel on YouTube, Spotify, or iTunes. Do you know a colleague or friend who might love this conversation? please forward the episode and ripple together with us. You can also pay it forward by leaving a review in Spotify or iTunes. Feedback means the world to us, and I love to connect with as many movement makers, soul shakers, and truth tellers in education. Let's awaken, deepen, and enrich our learning spaces with more moments of nourishment. And let's connect soul, soma, and science.